Wretched Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
I use the Complete Idiot's Guide to the Bible.
Unqualified.
Why can't my kids come into the service? Because we have PG-13 services.
Unqualified.
That has a nice ring to it. Unqualified. I've always felt that way.
It wasn't a compliment.
Junior church has taken over. It's designed for elementary kids or junior higher.
Who doesn't feel unqualified?
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Oh, boy.
It's the Wretched Radio Mail Call Delivery Bag Q&A Entertainment Nationwide Extravaganza featuring your voicemails, correspondences, communiques, dispatches, memorandums, and missives.
Any special message for all the kids watching at home?
What we need right now is a clear message to the people of this country.
You have 1,200 messages.
That is a bit above average.
Now here's your host, Todd Freakishly Tall Friel.
Wait.
Jamal is here!
Ooh. Okay, this is Wretched Radio. Thank you very much for sending stuff to idea@wretched.org. I asked, you answered. Thank you very much. I made a promise. I am going to attempt to keep my end of the deal. I said, if you disagree with me regarding the issue of adult men playing video games, please send me an email. I will try to treat you very respectfully, because, look, we're talking about something that doesn't quite hit the bullseye of orthodoxy. We're talking about how men spend their time. Is it an important issue? I don't think it's insignificant by any means. How we utilize our time, I think, frankly, in America, we should give more consideration to it than we currently do. In Western civilization, and that still includes Canada, wow, although Canada... Oh, the progressive movement is having such sway there. Ay, ay, ay. The Christian brothers and sisters in Canada have got to be pulling their hair out with their current leadership and the direction that their country is headed. And we're following right behind Canada. So there you go. We're right in your shadow. If you don't mind me saying so. How we consider using our free time is something that I just don't think we ponder a lot, because we have been inundated with messages that say you deserve a break today, that you need to have free time, downtime, you
soak
need a man cave.
Get away?
Something like that. It's
You've got
kind
me
of,
singing a McDonald's thing in my head now. Thanks.
I thought that was mine. Nuts! The culture screams rest. After all, everybody's working for the weekend. Isn't that what every DJ is about? Hey, it's hump day. You're almost there. Time to rest. Hold on. Now, this is not something that is prescriptive, but it is descriptive in the Old Testament. How hard did the Old Testament saints work in the Old Testament? Very hard. It appeared that when the sun came up, they went to work, and they didn't stop working till the sun came down. I grant you, different times of the year, that would be a shorter season. But those are long days, never less than 8 till 5, 7 till 5. Those are long days that they put in. Sometimes it could have been from 7 till 9 p.m. And God didn't seem to have, that's working too much, you need more rest. The rest time that they received was their Sabbath rest. Their Saturday in the Old Testament, they took a day off from work. Now, did they stop doing all chores around the house? Those rabbi rules, those rabbinical laws that Jesus railed against, they grew progressively into 39 columns of laws. So not initially. They probably still did chores. They did work around the house. They took care of stuff. But they had a day of rest. In America, man, when that whistle blows, you're done. It's chill time. Now, that is not a prescription that we need to be working like they did. It is a blessing if we get any free time. May I ask you a question? And this is not intended to be like, well, I've got this figured out and you don't. This is a wrestling match for all of us. How do you use your free time? Do you even think it through? That's really the issue for most of us. Just not taking the time to go, wait a second, how much time am I spending dilly-dallying? And there's nothing wrong with some dilly-dallying. Don't hear that I'm saying that there's not. Have you ever seen those TV shows where somebody is supposed to lose weight and it's the Biggest Loser or whatever the program happens to be? I remember seeing a glimpse of one, and the person who was overweight was supposed to write down the amount of calories they consumed, how much food they ate in a day. And they wrote it down. And even when they wrote it down, they didn't write down all the things that they ate. And so the producers of the show were like, you forgot about that stop at McDonald's. You forgot about the watermelon that you had after that. no, you didn't have 6 ounces of yogurt. You actually had 16 ounces of yogurt. Even when they were taking notes, they misjudged how much they were consuming. And I wonder if you and I don't do the same when it comes to discretionary free time. That we don't consider how much downtime we're spending. Am I going to make a law? Not where there is no law. I'm simply asking you, like I'm inviting myself to consider, how hard am I working for the Lord? How hard am I working for my family? How hard am I working for my local church? Those are the priorities of life. Then how much am I given to myself to just chill, catch my breath? I suspect that you and I get more free time than we think. And that is in part what this conversation is about, determining whether or not grown men should be playing video games. I said, if you disagree with my take of there's a better way to use your time, then send me an email. Well,
did you get one?
Oh, no, got a couple. And so I would like to share with you some of them, because a lot of the, you know, repeated some of the same themes, but there were many very thoughtful emails that were sent to idea@wretched.org. And the question that really jumped out, and I think it's a very fair one, I think Nate sent this one in stating, are you even familiar with video games? And I have to confess to you, the answer to that question is no. No, I'm really not all that familiar
with
video games.
Well, you got your Asteroids, you got your Pac-Man.
Wow.
You got your Pong.
Mario Brothers, don't forget the Mario Brothers.
Yep, I think that's it.
It seems to, now please don't laugh at me because I did not do exhaustive research on this, but I did look into video games more than I had in the past, and it seems that there are different types of video games.
There's GoldenEye.
Here's what my observation.
There's GoldenEye Slappers Only. There's GoldenEye Big Head.
What are you speaking in tongues over there? No, the categories.
Oh.
It seems to me that here's the categories that I observed. There are basically violent games, which I have to confess to you appears to be the majority of games. Warfare games. These are games that are killing people somewhat indiscriminately. Now, I know you can argue that this is done in a format that's, we understand that this is fantasy. I get that. But is that a dwelling on what is pure, lovely, and worthy of praise? Soldiers come back with PTSD for a reason. It's a serious thing to take a human life or to be involved in a campaign that does such, even if you are not doing it directly. Why would we want to be turning that into a game to play? I just don't think that that's fit for Christians to be doing that. I know, it's bad guys. Now, it's not a war game, it's bad guys. Right. Killing somebody? This is not a light activity, nor do I even think it qualifies for being an entertaining, healthy activity. Those appear to be, when I went through the top 10 lists of videos, if you look at the top 10 lists of videos over the last 40 years now, they judge it based on creativity, how it changed the platform, etc. I just noticed that the big games of the last several years are all violent games. Can we agree, no matter what the content is, violence, and please don't use the Bible has violence routine, because the Bible never glorifies violence. You say the Bible has a lot of sex in it. It never glorifies it. Yes, it does celebrate it, but never in a provocative way that is designed to entice or to arouse. It never celebrates sin. It never makes light of sin. And it doesn't treat it in a frivolous, glorifying manner. It is in the Bible because it exists in the world, and the Bible is a very real book. I don't think that that is an excuse to say that we can therefore be playing violent games. Reading violent books, yes, you can read a history book about World War II and what happened. You can read about what happened at the ovens of Dachau. Not to be glamorized, though. And it seems to me video games do that. Sorry, that was an aside. The other category appears to be games. What games of puzzles? Games where you have to solve some sort of a mystery puzzle? Now, I will tell you, it seems to me, I think that that could be again, everybody's discretionary time is just that. You have to figure out the amount of time you want to spend doing that. But it seems to me that that would be okay. I'll give on that. because I didn't study the categories, I would say that it's just like any other form of entertainment. That would be fine. I also think the videos that are sports related, you're playing tennis, it's a race car thing, as long as it's not a glorifying of who can I run into, crash and kill so I can win the race, I think those game things, fine even for families, because a lot of people wrote in and said, hey, we do it as a family activity. As long as it's not a dark one, I think discretionarily those things can be done. But here were some more emails that were sent in, and I'm going to leave names off of all of these. Everybody was very gracious, and I appreciate that very much, by the way. You were very, very, very gentlemanly and ladylike. There was a warning that was given. The addictive nature of these video games, they've torn families apart. People have experienced pain because their spouse just gets sucked right into it. I think that is also a warning that needs to be considered. So, am I amending my blanket condemnation of all video games for all times? I'm not sure I made that statement, but sure, I'd be happy to do that. Having said that, I think there's a warning attached to all video games, and I think that it is fair. Can we agree on this? These dark, murdering, violent games and certainly sexual games have no place in the Christian life? This is Wretched Radio. Couldn't say it any better than Michael Woolworth from Bible League International.
The world will drill wells and provide food and shelter. Those are very important causes.
Yes.
We smile favorably upon those. But getting God's word to believers half a world away, people you won't meet this side of eternity, that's on us as God's people.
Ain't nothing wrong with digging a well, but it is only the Christian church that can provide living water. Bible League International for decades, delivering Bibles to believers who have made a profession of faith, believers who have studied the basics of the Christian faith, are then given living water in the Word, a Bible. For just $5 per Bible, you could deliver a Bible to a believer overseas through Bible League International. Might it be possible you could send, say, 6 per month? Please call Bible League at 1-800-YES-WORD.
Thank you for being here. Glad you could spend part of your day listening to Wretched Radio. And thank you to all who are supporting Wretched and our Millennial Initiative. We do appreciate it. Our video series, Road Trip to Truth, hosted by John Fabares, is moving along nicely. Soon you'll be able to watch as John heads off to secular college campuses tackling the tough issues that the college kids are actually struggling with now. And hopefully the show will accomplish 3 things. One, it will help with the 70% of kids who leave the faith when they leave home and go off to college. 2, that it will help with the depressed, anxious, and suicidal generation that is at college now. And 3, it'll give you an understanding of what they're going through, what they're like, and how you can share the gospel of Christ with them. Those are the 3 things we're hoping to accomplish. Would you like to partner with us at Wretched? Go to wretched.org/donate and become a monthly gospel partner. Wretched.org/donate. Wretched. Amazing grace. Amazing gospel.
My special guest today is Dr. John MacArthur. Sir, what is the issue with the Master's Academy International?
The issue with TMAI is very simple. Biblical training. Training men to be the kinds of pastors that are defined and described in the New Testament.
Fascinating, sir, but there are so many ministries who encourage us to do acts of charity internationally.
I mean, it's fine to support philanthropy or some feeding of poor people or caring for children that have needs. But at the end of the day, the impact on a nation has to come from the pastors and leaders. So investing in that is making the maximum investment for the maximum impact.
Thank you, Dr. MacArthur. We're all out of time, or I'd love to ask you more questions. If you would like to support the mission of the Master's Academy International, training indigenous pastors to be biblical expositors, changing nations, you can do that at wretched.org/pastor.
Titles of Christ. In the Bible, Jesus is given many titles that teach us about who he is and what he has done. Jesus is called the firstborn. Jesus was the firstborn from death, resurrected that we may have life, and he is the firstborn over all creation. the preeminent Son, through whom we are adopted as sons and daughters of God the Father. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Can we learn anything about evangelism from a Muslim? Methinks so. This is Wretched Radio. I was reading a rather interesting article from Australia. That's right. Can any good article come out of Australia? I think so. This one from the Gospel Coalition, Australian style. By the way, speaking of Australia, many people send in stories to idea@wretchedradio.com from Australia, and I have got it buried somewhere in my mess here, but it was another demonstration that Australia is not trailing far behind the USA when it comes to progressive issues. Sorry to hear that, my Aussie Christian friends. And so this article was from a fellow at the Gospel Coalition who has been witnessed to, not been witnessing to, I'm sure he's been trying that, but has been witnessed to by a Muslim. Have you ever? They don't typically strike me as an evangelizing kind of group, but we're going to call this fellow M because, well, he's probably called Muhammad anyway, because the odds are really good. Was witnessing to this Christian, and here is what he observed about being evangelized by a Muslim. And you say, this is not going to apply to me because it's very unlikely I'm going to be evangelized by a Muslim. That isn't his point. He observed how this fellow did it. He observed how this man spoke, what his tactics were, and how he responded, which should be instructive for us to a degree. Because ultimately, it doesn't matter how somebody responds. Because the word is going to do what the word is going to do. The two-edged sword will cut, because it's by the power of the Holy Spirit. That is how God works, through the proclamation of his word. Why? Because it was inspired by the Holy Spirit. And so ultimately, it doesn't matter how somebody responds, but that is not to say that we are not mindful of good manners. Okay, all right. Bad sermon illustration, but frankly, I don't know of any other kind. Let's just say you have just had a garlic clove and you want to witness to somebody like, well, let's just say Tony, for instance. You want to witness to Tony because you have some concerns. And there you are just reeking of garlic. Would you say, well, it doesn't matter because the Holy Spirit is going to do what he does? Well, no, you put in a breath mint. You be mindful. Just be thoughtful. We don't want to put up little impediments along the way. And that also, I think, can be instructive when it comes to the things we say in our evangelism. Now, this should not edit us from speaking truth. It's just being thoughtful. This is the wise as serpents part. Gentle as doves, wise as serpents. So let's jump into the seven things he learned that we can learn about evangelism. Because you do share your faith, don't you? One, M seems more familiar with books about Islam than the Quran itself. That's interesting. So what does that say to the Christian who's getting witnessed to by the Muslim? Why don't you know your source material? Do you not have confidence in that book? I have met many Christians who love to quote theologians. They love to talk about, you name it, Aquinas, the early church fathers, but they don't love to quote the Bible. Now, what does that say to somebody? That our confidence is not in the Word. We should learn from that, and we should use the Bible a lot. The temptation is to read and talk about books about Christianity. You are subconsciously communicating. You don't think the Bible is true, powerful, or compelling. Let's use the book, shall we? Number two, when I asked M, what's the benefit of becoming a Muslim? He said, none. Made no difference to him if he became a Muslim. No compelling reason. So even though he was adamant about trying to convert the guy, he didn't offer anything. So what's the takeaway for us? We need to be convinced of the benefit of becoming a Christian. Now, we've got to be careful, as always. How many benefits are there to Christianity? I don't think anybody has completed the list yet. But let's remember that we don't want people coming for the bennies. We don't want them coming for the gifts. Come to Jesus, and increasingly, your conscience will be cleansed. You won't have those bad memories of your past life. Oh, that sounds good. I'm going to come to Jesus then. Now, is that true? Yes. Is that why somebody should come to Jesus? No. They should come to Jesus because they get to come to Jesus. We also need to be careful on this. I see this a lot. I do it myself, and I'm increasingly watching myself. The New Testament even does it, so that it's not like this is a sin. But I think we've been using the word gospel too much. Isn't the gospel great? Gospel's amazing, isn't it? Incredible gospel. We need more of the gospel. And if that language is certainly permissible. It's used in the Bible. Paul talks about his gospel. But let's not forget, the gospel is about Jesus. And so let's maybe, even as we evangelize or even talk to ourselves about these issues, we increasingly replace gospel with Jesus Christ. Because he's what the gospel is about. The gospel is not theology, per se. The gospel is the good news that you can have Jesus. You can be in a right relationship with God. That's what you get. You get the best thing in the universe. Run to him. Go. Now, are there other benefits? Yes. Do we talk about those benefits? Yes. But we don't hold those out as a draw card. We hold out Jesus. So let's perhaps all be thinking, nobody should get a ticket for this, but instead of using the word gospel so much, we talk about the person of Jesus Christ. He's the benefit of Christianity. Number three, whenever I raised a red herring like women are oppressed in the Quran, M would follow me down the rabbit hole. And away they'd go. And it was very easy to distract M from the real issue. Same thing is true for us. Watch out for rabbit holes. Answer those questions. Study your apologetics, but don't stay there. Get back to Jesus. Number four, every time I asked a question he thought was contentious, he'd send me a link to another document to read. Uh-oh. Let's be really careful about how often we do that. The response of this Aussie Christian was, I'm becoming resentful. You're asking me to read. This is too much work. I'm not interested. And I think we need to remember that. If we just give somebody a link, as amazing as we think it might be, it maybe holds, most likely holds no interest, and it becomes a burden to those we're witnessing to whom we're witnessing. Number five, Elma seems certain that if he won every argument, I would be compelled to become a Christian. Oh, I think we could all learn from that, can't we? It is not about winning arguments. Increasingly, I am learning this. Slowly, but increasingly, people aren't a mark. They're not a hit. They're not your opponent. They're the harvest field, and they're lost. And so when we see them as just somebody, they brought that up. I got to knock that down. It's off-putting to us when somebody else does that. We need to be remembering that it can be off-putting when we do it too. Number six, M befriended me on social media and then failed to consider the impact of his posts on Facebook. Oop, lots of rants. Unfair about the unfair treatment of Muslims by the media. Others were self-congratulatory articles about the superiority of Islam. And there they are in front of the world and to the Christians that they're trying to evangelize. And his response was, I didn't like it. Now, everybody needs to figure this out for themselves. We're talking about stuff on the radio, and a Muslim could be listening right now. I recognize that, and we should all be mindful of that. Sometimes I forget that. We shouldn't. Same thing is true with your Facebook page. If you're evangelizing somebody and you're talking about them, or it's some sort of derogatory article or some sort of superiority article about Christianity, which would be entirely true, you need to be mindful of what their response would be. And it might mean giving up your liberty to post an article like that because you have got a more evangelistic goal in mind. Number 7, M eventually said, okay, you win, when I made a compelling argument that he couldn't refute. It only happened once. But, nevertheless, he rarely conceded that we even agreed on something. What's the takeaway? Well, it's okay to win. I hated that we couldn't discuss anything without it being a knockdown fight. I was sure that there was much we agreed on, but it wasn't acknowledged. Outlining common ground is equally as important as discussing points of difference. Got to be careful with that, I think, because we don't want to give somebody the impression that we've got enough in common that there's no big deal. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, look, you believe in God, a concept of God, it's totally wrong. So do I. So we've got something sort of in common, but then, of course, we have to lay out the distinctives because the distinctives are eternal. What can we learn from witnessing to a Muslim? At least 7 things. This is Wretched Radio.
Books of the Bible. Luke was a physician and companion of Paul, who wrote an orderly account of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He meticulously details names, places, and events. Luke shows great concern for people of every class, especially overlooked or undesirable people. We are all from various places and classes, but Jesus Christ is the Savior for all mankind. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
There's another way to get a hold of us here at Wretched Radio.
1-7-7-2-8-2-BEEP.
That is the number of the old toll-free. Remember, if you are a pagan ixnay on the erring sway, try to be pithy as best you can. It helps Joey to be able to nap during the day. He appreciates that a lot. 1-877-282-BEEP.
I used to be a Buddhist. I was an imprint blasphemer of the Lord. Very bad. Persecutor of the Christian church. You name it, I said it. Potty language, the whole thing. Anyway, some years ago, I was by myself. Nobody was preaching the gospel to me. Hadn't been at church since childhood. Felt the call to ministry. Saw Jesus for who he was, for who I am. Felt a deep heartfelt repentance. Immediately found the church, enrolled in Bible college. This is all within 2 weeks of this experience. Went through the process of education and working in mostly charity-based ministries to eventually ordination, and am now and have been for some time a pastor. What do you think? Can a blaspheming Buddhist just be pulled to ministry before people asking him how many lies have he told?
That's a great question. Now I think, sir, forgive me if I'm not getting this right. There were two specific emphases, 2 points you were making. Number one, can somebody be saved like that? And the answer to that, I think, was found in the key, I hadn't been to church since I was a kid. Somewhere along the line, apparently, you have heard something about Jesus preached. You have heard the word. God has also given you a conscience. Apparently, you understood something about the cross to recognize that forgiveness was available in him. So, of course, you could be saved. I would have no reason to say not just because you weren't being preached to at the moment. What I think, though, people do is say these people are getting saved somehow without ever hearing the gospel. I just don't buy it. I don't buy their stories. Your story, sir, I think is completely consistent with a credible Christian testimony. You've heard the truth somewhere. It's just God convicted you then in that place from preaching from even years ago. Besides that, sir, I would also say that if you were indeed a persecutor of the church, you were certainly bumping up against Christian teaching, the Bible, as you were doing that. So that doesn't shock me or cause me to think, no, that God is not working outside or that God is somehow saving people without the preaching. No, he always saves with preaching. There's always preaching involved. Faith comes from hearing and hearing from the Word of God. Now, if the second point is, can somebody go into ministry that quickly and it can be fruitful? The answer to that is yes. Is that the biblical ideal? No, I don't think it is. A new believer shouldn't be put in that position. But it also seems, though, sir, that you had some training that was involved, so that should have allowed for some maturation. The ideal, I think, is that if somebody believes that they have a call to ministry, that they check out their gifting. How consuming of a desire is that? If you can do something else, you should. It is only if you think that you will perish if you cannot become a pastor that you feel that genuine call from God. And I think that that should be affirmed in your local church. And following the admonition that it is not good, it is not right for a new believer to become somebody who is in leadership, to become an elder. So even if you did it wrong, God can certainly bless that, but I think we would do well to follow the biblical prescription for when somebody should become a pastor. I'm very glad that God saved you, you blaspheming Buddhist you.
I was reading in my John MacArthur study Bible, James chapter 2, verse 24. I quote, "You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone." What do you think?
Oh, just that. What do I think? I think that if I only read James 2:24, that I might become Roman Catholic. But I'm not going to, because there is a bigger context. James is starting to make a little more sense to me. I mean, not understanding the import, but just the flow of the book of James. It's slightly more orderly than I used to give it credit for. And I still stick with this to a degree, but we need to be careful that we don't make James the New Testament book of Proverbs. It is filled with short, pithy statements of wisdom, but there is a flow, there is a train of thought. And the reason that I'm actually getting that is our pastor, he does a very fine job with the text. We're actually going through the book of James right now. And what we're seeing in the first chapter of James is just big thoughts, just a couple of big thoughts. It's not just a bunch of pew, 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 pew. Watch your mouth. Pew. There's a little piece of advice. You want wisdom? Ask for it. Pew. There's a piece. No, the whole thing flows together. And a part of the flow is an examination to see if you really are a believer. We tend to think 1 John is that book that has that territory covered. You'll see in 1 John, depending on how you want to count it, 10 to 15, give or take, closer to 10, I think, because there's some repetition with some nuances, signs that you're a Christian. If you say you have no sin, you deceive yourself. That's a test. So do you think you're sinless? You're deceived. There's a good chance you're not in the truth if you think you're perfect. Do you love the brethren? The true Christian doesn't just tolerate and put up with other Christians, hold your nose. You love them. You love fellowshipping with them. And on go the tests. James is also that way. He asks some questions. Is your tongue under control? That's a test. And as we get into chapter 2, what we start to see is his explanation that a true faith, it demonstrates itself in works. That is the import of James then chapter 2. The true faith has works that follow it. The works do not cause you to be justified. Once you have been justified, then you will do good works. So if I just took James 2:24 and just plopped it right out of context, I would read it and say, okay, here, you see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. You would go, well, then we have to have faith and works in order to be justified. And as always, never read a Bible verse. I always recommend when somebody comes to you and they say, hey, I got a Bible verse. What do you think about that? Try to read at least 5 verses, maybe as much as 10 verses. Go to where the paragraph break is, where the header break is that were inserted by men to help us with ease of organization. Read the verses before and read the verses after, and chances are it's going to clear it up for you. So I'm going to go back to verse 14. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and be filled, but you don't give them stuff to help them. What does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. I don't need to go any further. That explains it right there. If your faith doesn't have works, it is a dead faith. So then I can read with that thought in mind, verse 24. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith. Oh, I see what he means there is that I am justified. My works prove my faith. My works prove my justification. Now I'm going to read down and see what John MacArthur's footnote says. Oh, great. Thanks a lot, Dr. MacArthur. Verse 24. See note on verse 21. All right, now we have to read verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Now you say, that seems pretty straightforward. Hold on. Go read Galatians chapter 3 and 4. Talking 3, I think. The faith of Abraham. That he was saved by faith, because the book of Galatians is an admonition. No, don't let anybody tell you that works are necessary for faith. It couldn't be more clear, and we let the clear interpret the unclear. So what is James saying here? That true faith has works. Now let's go read what he said. Justified by works. This is John MacArthur's footnote on this verse. This does not contradict Paul's clear teaching that Abraham was justified before God by grace alone through faith alone. Cites Romans 3 and Galatians 3, 6, and 11. For several reasons, James cannot mean Abraham was constituted righteous before God because of his own good works. One, James already stressed that salvation is a gift. Chapter 1, 17 and 18. Two, in the middle of this discourse, verse 23, James quoted Genesis 15, 6, which forcefully claims God credited righteousness to Abraham on faith. Three, the works that James said justified Abraham was his offering of Isaac, an event that occurred many years after he exercised faith and was already declared righteousness. So instead, we've got a time issue there that clears it up. So what do I do with James chapter 2 and verse 24? You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith. I learned lots. I learned to not proof text. I learned to never read a Bible verse without the full context. And I read that genuine saving faith produces works. Are we saved by faith alone? Yes, but faith is never alone. It always produces, increasingly so, good works. I hope that answered your question, sir. This is Wretched Radio. If you have been looking for a reason to sponsor your very own Tomorrow Club in Eastern Europe, perhaps this story from Max, the national director in Ukraine, will inspire you to visit tomorrowclubs.org/wretched.
Arsene, just 5 years old, escaped his home and came to the camp. His grandmother would not let him. She was cursing all Christians. His grandmother sadly passes away. So he kept coming. Not only that, he brought his parents and they repented. So this family gives the house where the grandma used to live to the church. And that's where the Tomorrow Club meets.
And that story is not a one-off. Families getting saved constantly through the Tomorrow Clubs in Eastern Europe. Would you please consider supporting your own Tomorrow Club? 30 disciples, $30 per month. TomorrowClubs.org/wretched.
On behalf of everyone here at Wretched, let me thank you. Thank you for your ongoing generous support of Wretched. While the love of money most certainly is the root of all kinds of evil, it is nevertheless needed to pay the bills. And we are grateful that you've allowed Wretched to pay our bills for over a decade now. We don't take your support for granted. We're reaching more people than ever, and without being greedy, we want to reach even more. If you've never supported Wretched and you have the means, we would be grateful if you would prayerfully consider joining our gospel partners with your monthly tax-deductible support. Wretched.org/donate has all the details. Together, we can reach more and more people who are in desperate need of hearing the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. The more you give, the more we're able to give away. Visit Wretched.org/donate today. Wretched.org/donate.
Ultrasound machines save lives. Don't believe me? Then believe Dan Steiner of preborn.org.
That young woman come in, 18, with her boyfriend, and he's pushing her to abort, took her back into the ultrasound room. There's two hearts. It's twins. The father looks at that, this 19-year-old guy. He goes, I don't know what we're going to do, but I know what we're not going to do. We're not going to kill those two babies.
Ultrasounds work. When a mommy, a daddy sees a picture of their baby in the womb, 80% of the time they choose life. It is $28 per ultrasound. May I ask, how many ultrasounds could you provide? $28 per month. Please note, whilst Preborn is busy trying to save the lives of babies, they're trying to save the souls of mommies and daddies by preaching the gospel. Please consider supporting Preborn at preborn.org/wretched, preborn.org/wretched.
Important dates in Christian history. 1611. The Authorized or King James translation of the Bible in the English language is published. 54 scholars worked for 4 years on the project. The King James Version became the Bible of choice in the English-speaking world for over 400 years. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
1-877-282-BEEP. If and you've got a question, comment, conundrum, or snark.
There's a lot of debate that had been going on about Moses, whether he wrote the first 5 books of the Bible. One of the major debates was how could he have wrote the last chapter of his death? And a lot say that it should have been in the first parts of Joshua. Can you give any insight on that?
Yeah, I can, and I understand. Actually, I thought that debate was raging more like 10 or 15 years ago. Maybe it's surfaced somewhere in some academia circles. The debate is, did Moses write the books of Moses historically ascribed to him? And I'm going to stick with that historical position because, well, it is historical. There's an apparent challenge that exists not just at the end of the Pentateuch, the 5 books of Moses in Deuteronomy, going into the book of Joshua. You've got a beginning issue, too. Let's tackle them one at a time, shall we? And I will state this. The desire to ascribe these writings to somebody besides Moses, I don't get it. I don't understand it. I don't know why we want to take issue with the historical understanding that it was indeed Moses. Furthermore, Jesus was quoting these books as they were written by Moses. That's what I believe makes it so problematic and entirely unnecessary. And one of the arguments would be from Deuteronomy chapter 34. When Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan. And he showed them all, it goes into the next verses, this is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, I'm fulfilling my covenantal promise by giving this land to a particular group of people, but you're not going to get to see it, Moses. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there. If you recall, people have a tendency to go, God was kind of mean to Moses. No, Moses' sin against God was an awful sin. He was basically kicking God off of his throne and saying, I'm the one who execute justice around here. That did not please God. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died. How could Moses have written that? Keeps going. He buried him in a valley in the land of Moab. But no one knows his grave to this day. Moses was 120 years. How could any of this have been written after he actually was dead? All of these details. And the children of Israel wept for Moses. How could he have known about that? Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom for Moses. And it goes on. And since there has not arisen a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face in all the signs and wonders, and by all the mighty powers, so Moses was a great prophet. What do we do with all of this? How could he have known this? Well, there's a couple of options here because it's really just, 7 verses that we're talking about that would be in question. Who wrote those? Could it have been Moses knowing what was going to happen? I don't think that we should take that option off the table. Why? Because go to the problems of the beginning of the books of Moses. How did Moses know what happened in creation? How did Moses know what happened And for all, how did he know what happened to Joseph? How did he know about those 400 years? How did he know any of that stuff? Divine inspiration. Now, granted, there's also the issue of these stories were passed down by mouth, that they were, Moses researched it, and these true stories, they're not allegories, these true stories, they were passed down from generation to generation exceedingly accurately. And so, yes, he did work off of those stories, but it was also divine inspiration to make sure that everything that he wrote down that he was enshrining for the rest of the age until God comes back to judge the world would be accurate and right. And so I would say it could have been Joshua who wrote these things down. Now, if Joshua wrote down that little post-mortem, does that change the authorship of Moses with Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy? I don't think that it does. And there's no reason, really, other than a desire to just be clever academically, to change that Moses was the author of these books, especially when the New Testament says the books of Moses. That is the big problem here.
My husband loves dogs. I cannot stand them. Long story short, We got one anyway, and it put me on crutches the last trimester of my pregnancy. Now I can't stand them even more. We ended up getting rid of that dog. My husband, he still loves dogs. The thought of owning one again stresses me out, and I can't stand it. It makes me want to break down in tears. My question to you would be, what would your advice be to us?
That's a hard one because I'm like your husband. I really love dogs, but I love my wife a lot more. So, sir, if you're listening, taking your wife's side on this deal. I don't like to get involved in skirmishes, typically that involve churches, etc. But this is why. There's my 2 cents worth giving in about coming in about 1.38 cents these days. This is why I would say that when a husband and a wife live together. If one of the spouses feels strongly about an issue that is not an essential familial issue, it is not a theological issue, it's not a church issue, give it up. Just give it up. And just in case you think that maybe I'm not putting my dog where my mouth is, and you don't want to do that, by the way. The amount of germs on a dog's mouth, yeah. I don't care what they say, there's germs on that there mouth. Be careful with the licking and the kissing with your dog. I'll put my money where my mouth is. My wife has informed me, sort of subtly, boing, that when Charlie goes, sniff, sniff, that maybe we should wait a bit to see if we want to get another dog. Now, I love dogs. There are some of us that are just, that we're just kind of nuts about dogs. We really like them. I can't see a dog, unless it's a poodle variation, I can't see a dog and not be completely drawn to it. Like, I got to go pet that dog. I'll walk by a dog, and I know that it's inappropriate to, like, bend over and pet the dog. I still will, like, underneath my breath, hey, buddy. I can't help it. My wife doesn't want a dog. I'm not getting the dog. It is not worth it. I want my wife's happiness more than my own happiness. And if that is something that gets up her nose, why in the world would I want to import that into the marriage? Why, you just don't. Marriage is simply about sacrificing. It's about giving up. Now, having said that, that would be, sir, so sir, if you're listening, love your passion for pooches, but I would suggest that it's time to say goodbye to the hound if your wife wants the dog to go. Having said that, madam, why do you hate the dog so much? Is it just, I hate dogs. Is it something that you think that you could possibly grow to actually start to tolerate and enjoy? So my then encouragement to you, madam, would be until that day to start to forgive your husband for his decision, if it went against your will and wishes, to forgive him. And try to work hard to actually learn some way to not just tolerate, but actually like that pooch. Why? Because your husband loves that pooch. Now you say, well, which one is it? And the answer is it's both. That's what it is. That's what a marriage is. I don't want to do something that causes my wife frustration. And if I do that, it would be her role then to try to forgive and put up with, as long as we're not talking about an ongoing sin issue here, because we love each other, and vice versa. And I'm not suggesting anything publicly that my wife has ever done anything to sin against me or to make a decision that I didn't like. Never, ever, ever happened. But if it did, I would strive to go, okay, if it means that much to her, how can I put my own desires aside to learn how to love what she loves? That's the marriage dance, putting aside my own desires. So who gives on this? Sir, you give. Madam, you give. And in the process, both of you will be setting aside your own needs, your own desires, your own rights even, for the satisfaction, for the good of somebody else. I'm trying to think of somebody who did that very thing to the point of death, even death on a cross. Oh yeah, you're both going to be like Jesus. Now, if you both can work toward that end, it'll resolve itself. One way or the other, it'll resolve itself. With the result being not whether or not you have to vacuum up a lot of hair or not, but that you will both look like Jesus. This is the key type of issue in the home that you should focus on like a laser. Communication, important. Romance, important. Dealing with in-laws, important. But we must learn how to deal with sin issues, offense issues, because if we can't get past this, I don't care how well you communicate. If you don't learn how to forgive and to sacrifice so that you don't wound, hurt, or offend others, you got long sledding in front of you with Alaskan Malamutes.
Malamutes.
Hey, Malamutes. Oh, that you had one.
I did.
Until tomorrow.
Don't have another one.
Until Robin said it's got to go. Go serve your king.